This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogaeus, sitting in for Terry Gross. The news is full of stories about what's best for babies, and it's easy for new parents to get the impression that there's only one right way to raise kids. Anthropologist Meredith Small says that if you consider how many different kinds of parenting styles there are all over the world, you'll never fall into that trap. Meredith Small teaches anthropology at Cornell University. Her new book, Our Babies Ourselves, examines a new science called ethnopediatrics, which is the study of how parents of vastly different cultures care for their infants and how their parenting affects the baby's health. For instance, when it comes to the obsession of most new parents, sleep. I asked Meredith Small whether all infants share the same sleep patterns.
Well, no, they don't. And some of that may be physiological, but some of that is also culturally mandated. In North America and in Western Europe, what we'll call the West here, we expect babies to sleep long and hard. And whenever your infant begins to sleep through the night, everybody congratulates you on this wonderful developmental achievement. But if we look at other cultures, babies are not expected to sleep through the night. And as a matter of fact, adults aren't even expected to sleep through the night. In hunter-gatherer societies, the night is punctuated by people getting up, going around the fire, talking, getting something to eat. The Yanomami in the Amazon sleep in huge houses with several families together, and there's always somebody awake. So a baby is not expected to sleep long and hard. They're expected to sleep very lightly, and they're expected to wake up, go back to sleep, and they're also expected to sleep during the day very lightly.
There is some research that points to a lower rate of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome, in cultures where babies do sleep with their parents. Are there various interpretations of this?
Well, dealing with SIDS is pretty difficult because the etiology of the syndrome is unclear to everyone. But one thing we do know is that the United States, Western culture, has the highest rates of sudden infant death in the world. Other cultures, it's non-existent or extremely low. It can't be a coincidence that in cultures where babies sleep with an adult, there's such a low rate of SIDS. Physiological research has shown that if you wire up a mother and a baby who don't normally co-sleep, but you put them together for a night in the sleep lab, the EKG and heart rate and breathing and all this will physiologically demonstrate that they do a nighttime tango. Mother goes through levels of sleep, baby follows through those levels of sleep, or baby goes through level, mother follows. And when the baby stops breathing, which is called an apnea, and all babies do that, mother's breathing tends to kick that baby back into breathing again. Another thing that happens, also again on infrared tape, is researchers have shown that mother spends a lot of time, even fast asleep, patting the baby, moving the blankets around, being very vigilant, even though she's, you know, way in a deep level of sleep. So the combination of that physiological tango and the vigilance surely must have some sort of positive effect to prevent SIDS. But let me say that co-sleeping is not going to stop SIDS. Just that for some babies, and when sleeping conditions are really good for the mother and the infant and very healthy, it probably has real physiological benefits for baby.
It's this huge decision that parents make whether or not to let their babies and their children sleep in their bed. And some take the route of the official family bed, that they organize their lives around making it possible that you can all sleep in their bed. And of course, others, most of us train our children to sleep alone. And I believe the law of the land here from the American Academy of Pediatrics is that they advise parents not to have children sleep in the bed, that it doesn't promote good sleep hygiene.
It's interesting that you say it's a huge decision. For Western culture, it's a huge decision. In 90% of cultures around the world, a baby always sleeps with an adult, either in the same room and most often in the same bed. It's only for Americans that it's a huge decision. And that comes from a cultural history of thinking of the bed as a private place for mom and dad, that mom and dad have this relationship and it's separate from family and it's sacrosanct and baby shouldn't be in there. And also the sexualization of the bed, baby shouldn't be in there. But for other cultures, it's no big deal. Babies always sleep with their parents.
All this really does put letting the baby cry it out in a different perspective.
Oh, it certainly does. If comparing different cultures once again, on the issue of crying, I mean, crying is a communication from the baby. People say, oh, the baby's trying to manipulate you. Well, in fact, yes, they are. The baby is demonstrating its internal state, and babies are really good at that. That's what they're supposed to do. And parents are designed really to respond to that. In other cultures, non-Western cultures, especially, let me use, for example, the Kung San of Botswana, often known as the Bushmen. In 90% of the time when babies cry, mothers respond within 10 seconds to that cry. Contrast that to America, where in only 40% of the time, mothers respond within, say, 60 seconds, and often they don't respond at all. And this, again, comes from a cultural history that we want these babies to learn to self-comfort, to be independent and self-reliant. But it's a little strange to me that the baby is just signaling something so natural, and we're working against our natural tendency to go over and pick that baby up and comfort them.
What does this tell us about this issue of colic? And I believe the research points to the fact that colic is a phenomenon of developed nations, that maybe, first of all, it's more about what our expectations of infants are. We don't want them to cry ever. It's seen as a failure, a parental failure, instead of a natural communication.
That's part of it. That's part of the answer. The pediatric definition of colic is crying for more than 3 hours on three nights of a week for 3 weeks in a row. That's the medical definition. Now, when parents bring their babies in because they're crying too much and they say the baby must have colic, often the baby is just doing that normal crying curve, but the parents' expectations are quite different. They expect the baby to be more quiet. Sometimes, when parents are questioned, their babies do cry that much, but they are more tolerant of the crying and their expectations are less. It's interesting that there is no evidence of any definition of colic in Asian populations, the one group that has been studied. So it's just plain interesting. Why do we have colic in Western culture? Again, it may be this caretaking package. We're not responding to the babies. Babies are most often in Western culture horizontal rather than vertical, and it looks like when babies are held in a sling, as some babies in America now are, their digestive process works better. So physiologically, they being horizontal may not be so good for them as well.
Let's talk about breastfeeding. I was really astonished to read in your book that the Kung Bush women nurse their babies about every 13 minutes.
Yes.
is that how...
Makes you tired, doesn't it?
I mean, that's pretty much constantly. Is that how babies were nourished for millions of years?
Probably so. We don't know for sure because the Kung San, of course, are a modern population. But because they're living in a subsistence pattern that was much like our ancestors, say, 2 or 3 million years ago, we can get some clues from them about how ancient human babies were probably cared for. But keep in mind that statistic of their nursing every few minutes is part of this whole package where they're held in a sling and they are right next to mother's breast. So it's not as if the mother is sitting down and taking out her breast in an arena where this is not acceptable. The baby is inside that sling and the baby itself is scooching around and putting the nipple in the mouth. These bouts are also reasonably long. Now, we tend to call that on demand, but really, it's more continuous breastfeeding.
What implications does this hold then for us, where most women, if they do indeed breastfeed, probably nurse a baby maybe every 2 hours, sometimes even every 4 hours, if they believe in some kind of feeding schedule?
Sure. Even the women who are part of La Leche League, who are very devoted to a more continual style of breastfeeding, only breastfeed on average about once every hour. So there again, we even have a contrast between a more hunter and gather pattern and a more modern pattern. Well, what happens is, interestingly enough, is that the composition of breast milk actually changes over time. The human breast is not designed with a storage facility behind the nipple, so that as milk is manufactured higher up in the ducts and it comes down behind the nipple, if it sits there for a while, the fat content is resorbed back into the body, and what's left is a more watery milk, so that when baby goes to nurse again, what it first gets is watery milk, and it takes a while before the fat content milk, which is being manufactured higher up, comes down and out the nipple. So if you're going to breastfeed at long intervals, the baby's not going to be so happy for a while, and it has to breastfeed for a longer period to get sated. And again, it may be part of the answer of why Western babies cry so much.
My guest is anthropologist Meredith Small. Her new book is Our Babies, Ourselves. We'll talk more after a moment. This is Fresh Air. Back with anthropologist Meredith Small. Her new book is Our Babies, Ourselves, How Biology and Culture Shape the Way We Parent. Another parental fixation is to what extent our parenting influences the development of our children's personality, how much we shape our kids. What does a cross-cultural look at personality and parenting add to that debate over inborn traits versus conditioned ones or nature versus nurture?
That's a real tough question. The information on things like temperament and personality, we know it's there. We know that babies are born with, or people are born with, some kind of genetic component. We all have a certain kind of brain, a certain kind of temperament. But from the day of birth, we're interacting with parents and other individuals. But each culture has a kind of ideology that is important to them. And it's so ingrained in who we are that we don't even think about what this ideology might be. Again, for Americans, it's the issue of independence. But looking cross-culturally, there are a vast array of what parents might want for their children. Let me give you a couple of examples. In Japan, which is a nice comparison because this is an industrialized modern society, but they have a very different cultural ideology in their parenting. They believe that babies are sort of a soul out there that needs to be brought into the family and society. And to do that, they make sure baby sleeps between mom and dad. Children sleep with their parents until they're teenagers, in fact. They integrate the baby very quickly into family and society. It's a collective idea. Contrast that, say, with the Gusii, a population in western Kenya. These are small plot horticulturalists who live in family compounds. And there's a garden out back, and sometimes father is out working on someone else's farm or an industrial place, and he comes back. Well, their ideology is that a good baby is one who is obedient and quiet and stays within the family. And they practice this by, although babies are carried at all times by mother or older sister or someone like that, they don't verbally stimulate their babies, which, of course, Americans find completely insane. I certainly do this with my daughter. We're always talking to her, always showing things, thinking this is going to make her smart. The Gusii believe if you do that, you bring up a selfish, self-centered child that will not be an obedient part of the family. Now, Gusii babies, it's not that they're not stimulated at all. They're constantly with the family. They're held all the time. They're seeing everything everybody sees. They're part of the conversation. But they are not personally visually stimulated.
Another one of the big decisions that parents in America face today is just how are we going to take care of our kids if we can't afford to stay home with them, or one parent can't afford to stay home with them. What's best, one person at home with just your children, or a nanny at home with a couple of neighborhood kids, or a large daycare center? And I've read recent studies that say children in these large daycare centers have fewer behavioral problems than children raised at home or in a smaller venue. What does the research into infant biology and cross-cultural parenting styles say to this? What kind of advice does it give parents in trying to navigate these choices?
Well, I hate to give real advice, but if we look cross-culturally and again in deep time, with this idea that the nuclear family is historically very recent and that kids were probably brought up in a multi-group setting, daycare doesn't come off as such a bad idea. It's great for kids, especially in a population where the birth rate is down so low. To have an only child at home for the first 2 years is probably biologically very different than what this baby is designed to do. Good daycare with familiar partners. Certainly they would probably have been kin a million years ago. But familiar partners to play with, familiar daycare workers, it's probably not such a bad idea.
This is getting a little bit away from babies, but there's been a lot made lately of a trend these days towards lessening unstructured time that children have just to play around outside, away from their parents. There's you know, more homework. There's such an academic emphasis, even in preschools. Some schools have done away with recess and even their playgrounds. And parents just aren't around so much, so kids are in these scheduled activities, either play dates and daycare, and the kids are getting fatter. There are some theories about a rise in asthma and allergies because kids just don't play outside enough. It seems as if there is that our social structure really is working more and more at odds with a child's biology.
Sounds so depressing, doesn't it? But again, there's a little cultural ideology in there. In Western culture, we believe that childhood, and again, we're getting away from babies, but the childhood is a time of freedom and play. In other cultures, once kids are able to walk and be part of the household, they often have tasks and chores. If you go to Africa, you see these 5 and 6 year old girls carrying around their baby brother. So they're contributing to the household. In Western culture, we see children not as an asset, but as a burden, because in fact, they really don't contribute to the household. But in other cultures, they are a working member of the household, either with domestic chores or out in the garden. So maybe we should have them do some housework or something rather than go off to music lessons.
You're a parent of a daughter?
Yes, I am. Yes.
An infant?
She's 8 months old, yeah.
How has all of the work that you do in this area changed or influenced how you deal with your baby?
Well, it's interesting. I finished the book long before the baby came, and several of my friends said to me once she was here, said, "Oh, now how do you really feel about all those wacky anthropological ideas you had?" And I have to tell you that I feel more strongly than I did before I had a child. My daughter has been carried in a sling, except for now when she's crawling around. She sleeps with us, and I'm glad she did because I think I would have been up every 10 minutes to make sure she was okay. And as a result, we look pretty good for parents with a new infant. We don't look like we need any sleep. And this is only, as we say in science, an N of one, but frequently, although people told me, put that baby down, we have a really happy baby, and people are always commenting on what a great girl she is and how happy she is. So I guess it worked for me.
You say you carried your child, your daughter, all the time. Do you really mean all the time? Like, and how could you do that and keep up your career as an anthropologist?
Yeah, it's a good trick. I do mean almost all the time. I mean, obviously, I didn't carry her every second of the day. But around the house, I have this sling. You can buy these anywhere. It's a piece of cloth with a ring on it. I also have a long piece of cloth that I bought in Indonesia years ago that I sometimes tie around. And she was stuck in the sling and pulled real tight, and she would sleep in the sling, and in fact, my hands were free. So it was very easy to sit down and type and do my email and write magazine articles when she was sleeping. And when she's awake, she actually was very happy she was happiest as we went about our business with her in the sling. And since I share the childcare with my husband, he wore the sling too, and again, we just went about our business like people working out in the rice fields or digging up roots, and she seemed to be real happy with that.
You know what makes it hard for me to read some of this research? Parenting styles differ so much even within one family. I mean, not only across cultures or across America, but you parent each child in a family even differently. There seems to be no real norm, or that when we talk about how Americans do this or the Japanese do this, it is speaking these vast generalities.
Yeah, the thing to really keep in mind is that with any parental strategy or any human behavior for that matter, it's a trade-off. So let's say you're a parent who decides to sleep with your kid, have your kid in bed with you in the evening. That's great for the baby. You may sleep better, but it is absolutely going to interfere with the intimacy between a husband and wife. That's the trade-off. Let's say you're a Kung San woman who carries your baby around all the time. This baby doesn't cry. It's very happy all the time, but you've got to carry this 20 pounds around with you everywhere you go. So for that, every decision we make, it's a trade-off. And what's important to know is that you have those choices, is that there are other ways to do things. There isn't just the American way or the Kung San way. You really can borrow from other cultures, although it's often hard to go against what is culturally acceptable. Such things as breastfeeding in public or carrying your kid in a sling all the time. You do receive comments from people walking down the street or from your family. But you have those options. And that's what I wanted to write about in this book, that there are different ways to parent, and you can borrow some of those ideas if you want to.
Meredith Small, it's been a lot of fun talking to you today. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Meredith Small's new book is Our Babies, Ourselves. Coming up, we remember Linda McCartney. This is Fresh Air.